Hi friends, welcome. Welcome, welcome. Hello everybody. Good morning, wherever you are joining us from today. My name is Eddie Chavez Calderon. Super happy to be here with one of my colleagues and friends who I've had the honor to be able to educate lots and lots of teens from across the country on not just immigration, but anti-Semitism and Jewish communal efforts to be united in some of the most darkest times. So I'm really, really happy that we get to bring in my great friend, Randy Freed. And Randy recently, since October 7th, was has served as a member of the WJC, the Jewish Diplomatic Corps. Randall Freed has made a significant impact on over 8,000 people across the United States and around the world. He has committed to tackling pressing societal changes in education, healthcare, religious, and corporate spheres. Through his active role in WJC, Changemaker delegations to Israel, Randall has gained firsthand insights into the struggles and resilience of communities touched by the events of October 7th. By leveraging his platform within the WJC Speakers Bureau, he's been able to share these critical insights, enhancing the understandings among the wide audiences. Randy's work is defined by his dedication to fight anti-Semitism, encouraging meaningful dialogue on issues related to Israel, challenging all forms of bigotry, and sparking conversations that contribute to a more inclusive world. Recently, Randy is the director of philanthropic engagement and communication at SEDEC America, who we absolutely love. Huge shout out to our friends from SEDEC America and our great friend, Avram, who's just an amazing human being, and everybody at SEDEC America's team. He has 16 years as a lead educator for the March of the Living program and has focused on combating anti-Semitism. His 2 decades in education and advocacy has taken him across the country to teach and speak at schools and synagogues alike. I cannot emphasize the immense amount of educational just flame and chutzpah that Randy brings in to be unapologetically Jewish, unapologetically Latino, and to be proud of both of those cultures in synchrony. It's just a beautiful thing to see. And I think that a lot of people look at a lot of speakers and see, wow, that's a great speaker. But to translate that into an educator is a very unique thing that I think a lot of people miss out on. And to see those levels of leaders, it is just incredible. So we are just honored to have you, Randy. Thank you so much for all of you who are joining us live on Facebook and who will be listening to the recording. You have a treat here with our great friend, Randy. Randy, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Wow, with an intro like that, I'd love to bring you with me everywhere. Thank you very much. Of course, the love is mutual for you, for Rabbi Shmuley and Arizona Jews for Justice. It really is a pleasure and honor to get to work alongside you and learn from you. And just excited to be here to talk about, of course, which I think is kind of the on everyone's kitchen table conversation, or at least certainly in Jewish households, the issue of anti-Semitism.
Thank you. Randy, I would love for you to talk to me a little bit more and for our audience a little bit about your journey, because you were actually in Israel prior to October 7th, very freshly into the war. Tell us what you experienced, and I would love for you to tell us a little bit walking backwards now. What are you experiencing now?
Sure. So actually, post in last year, I was had the privilege of being in Israel 3 times. In June, I was there for a conversation with a number of organizations, including the World Jewish Congress and hosted by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And we were talking about the dilemma of how do we fill the void or bring together Jews in the diaspora with Jews in Israel? And there was this sense that that Jews in Israel didn't really know the diaspora, care about the diaspora, or know why they should care. And then October 7th happened, and I think the common phrase that we heard in Hebrew over and over again is "ein milim," that there are no words to describe what had happened on October 7th. And so within a month, I got a phone call on a Wednesday, dropping my kids off for, at school. And they said, okay, Randy, there's a last minute trip to Israel happening. Can you come pack your bags? And by that Saturday, I even joked with a friend of mine, a rabbi. I was like, look, I'm going to fly on Shabbat. What do you think? He's like, you're going for a good reason. Go ahead. And I was on the ground Sunday. I was in, and of course, the tenor and tone of the country was very different. It was bare, not even a month into the war. And I was in Kfar Aza, and saw the absence of presence, this once thriving, really a jewel of the kibbutzim in the south. And saw the devastation there. I was in Sderot for a briefing with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. I was in Palm Achim Air Force Base, which that in of itself was really moving to be able to stand with air defense unit troops. These are young 18, 19, 20-year-olds, and to really hear their sense of optimism, not just about the practical of winning a war, but the idea that their Jewish identity and their Israeli identity kind of rolled into one, in this idea that though I have a dream, I want to be an engineer, I want to open a restaurant, I want to do whatever, instead of feeling defeated, those dreams were kind of just put on hold. And they're like, well, I can't wait to finish this up so I can go back to opening a business. Or some people said, I'm inspired to move to the South. The next day, we were at Kibbutz Shva'im, which is where most of the survivors of Kfar Aza were taken in, to meet with them. And then we met with a number of hostage families. And so that, of course, it goes without saying, it was a very emotional. Alex Dancing, especially, I think we're talking about hostages, is one of several. He's 75. It's why I wear my one of many reasons I wear for a dog tag for the hostages. Alex is a Polish-born Israeli who has taught most all of the guides at Yad Vashem and most of us who do touring in Poland on the ground. He taught us a lot of what we know, and he's currently one of the hostages. So it was very it was a, I could go on, but it was a very emotional time. But there was thankfully also something very beautiful, this idea that civil society really galvanized both in Israel and I think the Jewish people across the world, kind of closed ranks in solidarity with Israel, but also to address the rise of anti-Semitism that we saw that we see all around us.
Thank you. Randy, with the horrors that you witnessed after October 7th, and I would love for you to maybe talk to us a little bit about the connections of the levels of anti-Semitism that you have seen in the wake of October 7th in comparison to the historic levels of anti-Semitism that you very much know in Poland with your experience of the March of the Living.
So there's a couple of things. I mean, people oftentimes like to talk about anti-Semitism in Poland or anti-Semitism in Europe. And one of the reasons, like at Tzedek America, even when you talk about social justice issues and the social challenges of any form of bigotry and hate, I often tend to say that we should look at our own backyard first, because there's plenty here before we start to look at what we see in other places around the world. That isn't to say that anti-Semitism doesn't exist. It certainly does. But I think we should start in our own backyard. In terms of how it has changed, I think two things. One, anti-Semitism, there's a big, well, back up first. There's a big debate within the world of academia about is anti-Semitism and is the Holocaust even something that we can use as a tool to bridge to other forms of bigotry and other forms of genocide as a learning tool to make it more relational. So some say yes, and others say these are in many ways singular things that you can't really compare to other things. And I tend to be in the latter camp. I think that for so number one, anti-Semitism is a bit amorphous. It's always changing, right? Jews were hated because we had money, then we were hated when we didn't have money. We were hated when we were socialists, now we're hated for being capitalists. We were hated when we didn't have a home and we didn't have a country of our own, and now we are hated for having a country of our own. And it feeds into kind of conspiracy theories that tend to go around as Jews, which is as old as time. And so, in that way, I don't think that anti-Semitism can be compared to other forms of bigotry. And similarly, the Holocaust is a singular moment in time where we see this wide, from a government policy position, to eradicate the Jews. And also, I think though there are similar themes, I think we just have to be careful that we can apply to today. We just have to be careful how we apply them. In terms of anti-Semitism we're seeing today, I think there's two things that are happening. I think that post-World War II, post the creation of the State of Israel, like saying, you hate someone as a Jew for religious reasons is taboo. And what we've really seen is this kind of anti-Semitism 2.0, or Jew hatred, as I prefer to call it. Let's speak plainly about what it is. That some calling someone, you're just a Zionist, that's really, you could. 50 years ago, you could just send the word Jew, right? And there's this attempt to bifurcate Jews from Israel. Even though Zionism, yes, is a political movement that dates back to the 19th century, Zionism also clearly is embedded in a part of our religious identity and in part of our peoplehood that for some reason people want to diminish or deny, even though the two are intrinsically tied to one another. And so, even though in theory someone can be critical of the Likud government, Lord knows many Israelis are. Israel has held five elections in 4 years, so certainly Israelis know embrace the democratic process. While in theory you could be anti-Zionist, there are very fringe groups of religious Jews, non-religious Jews. According to the latest poll, 89% of Jews in the U.S., for example, support Israel. But there's this 11% that have problems with Israel to varying degrees. So you could theoretically be anti-Israel or anti-Zionist and not anti-Semitic. The problem is if you go to any of these protests, almost always the language that they're trafficking in is classic anti-Semitism. And so I think we're seeing that the line kind of being blurred between what is legitimate critique of a government and what's good old-fashioned hatred of Jews. And the last thing I'll say too, especially in terms of like progressive groups, I think that the real challenge is, I mean, I think everybody has this, right? We're oftentimes not aware of our own blind spots. Even the most progressive voices that we hear and kind of the anti-racism movement, which I think has made it harder for those in progressive circles to admit their own blind spots and their own bias. There's this notion that if you have a diverse society, then automatically everyone's going to be kumbaya and think the same and be anti-racist. Unfortunately, I think that's a very naive position. And but because we're talking past each other and because social media has amplified the way we speak about this subject, then we're not really listening to each other. And we see, and then it becomes kind of a herd mentality. And we're seeing, especially on college campuses, I spend a lot of time speaking at high schools and colleges across the country, and that's where it seems the most virulent. But there's an unwillingness to want to even listen and sit down. And we, it's a very, it's sad. It's very nasty. It's like a majority is wanting to tell the minority what they are, which is something theoretically everyone should be against, but certainly in progressive circles, something that we push against.
Exactly. Randy, something that we're noticing right now is this tactic to really shift the narrative and point Jews as just white people who are emphasizing the like narrative storytelling that Jews are part of now the white supremacy system that is oppressing every single sort of minority in our Western system here in the United States. That has been something commonly that we have noticed. How do we combat this? How do we stop this type of narrative from spreading where people are just equating Jews as a part of these like white folks who are holding and being gatekeepers of power and somehow oppressing people of color.
Wow, how much time do we have? No, I think so. I think it's, I mean, look, it's a big question, and I struggle with the answer because if I can get someone to at least engage in a conversation, I think, you know, especially for you and I as Latinos, there's this knee-jerk want the for other, not for all, but for some, right? In Latino circles that want to say, okay, well, so you have to choose a side. And we, even though those same circles would talk a lot about intersectionality, and they would talk about owning your identity and being proud, suddenly on this one issue, it's like you have to choose a side. And so the first thing is I think to remind people and try to traffic in their own language about who we are and being unapologetically clear that I'm Jewish, I'm Latino, and it doesn't. Like full stop, right? I don't need someone else to qualify who I am or how I have how am I Latino? Like who, which side of the family? How are you Jewish? And what does that mean? And how does it go? I think we have to, in some levels, we have to stop trying to qualify our identity because when we see others, we don't ask if someone says I'm Black or if someone says I am a multi-ethnic or interfaith or whatever it may be. We don't say suddenly, well, how, prove it to me or give me the flow chart that explains how you come to this identity. The other part is that somehow, which I think kind of comes from an anti-racism, is I think we have moved to this place where if you make progress, if you achieve privilege of any kind or power, that automatically somehow makes you guilty. And once you have that, in some circles, I say it can't be revoked. But this isn't true. And I think the anti-Semitism of the day proves it. In other words, this is the way I typically mean it. If we think about George Floyd was murdered by Derek Chauvin, and loads of people came out to protest in support of Derek Chauvin. He Blue Lives Matter, vilifying the victim, the police are our rights, we shouldn't question them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When Tyre Nichols was murdered in Memphis, there was no Blue Lives Matter. There was no let's vilify the victim. There was no let's believe the police. In an instant, this like supposed privilege that these officers had evaporated in a second, and it was a bunch of angry, violent Black men murdered another Black man. And this racism kind of, these racist tones kind of just magically appeared. So this notion of privilege the Jews have, or that we're white, I think we have to sit down and just say, like, well, what about all the other Jews that aren't white? Number one. And number two, who said the Jews are white? Did anybody ask Jews if they're white? Did somebody say, hey, do you want to be in the club? I mean, I know from my own father hearing the stories of, you know, there were signs that would say no Blacks, no Jews, no dogs. So one is, I think, to reassert the diversity of the Jewish tent, number one. And number two, I think we have to somehow start acknowledging that just because Jews have reached some level of success, which by the way, we're not a monolith. There are Jews that have money, there are Jews that don't have money. There are Jews that are bigots and racist, and there are Jews that are not. We are not a monolith. And I think that we have to start being proud of who we are, not apologizing. And maybe perhaps part of the process too is that we have to, in terms of trying to educate, is to find the places where we can just break bread, if you will, and tell our story. I think a lot of people have a lot of opinions about who Jews are, though they may not actually know any Jews and understand what that means to the Jews that they know.
100%. And with that, like, misunderstanding or clear no understanding of even understanding Jewish culture, as a Latino from Mexico, being in progressive spaces, working a lot to defend a lot of migrant families, to stand up against anti-immigrant policies. I've been embedded into the community, and I've also been deeply hurt by anti-Semitism that is coming from people of color, that is coming from communities that I grew up with, that I felt were fighting for justice and equity for all of us. And that somehow has now shifted. Prior to all of this, I have not experienced the levels of anti-Semitism that I have now. And frankly, I want to be honest, I think I've experienced more anti-Semitism in my life than I have experienced racism. And that is something that to me speaks volumes of the level of hate that comes here. How do we divide and go past the hate that is coming out from our own communities? And how do we establish dialogues? Because we're seeing a level that is shutting down dialogue, that is shutting down the ability to even sit down and maybe be uncomfortable for a second, but to listen to each other.
Ooh, well, part of that I think is the culture, the cancel culture. I don't like what I'm hearing. I'm going to cancel it. And I think that that's the one of the and that and the algorithms of social media that just put us in an echo chamber to reinforce our own views. That right there is the biggest one of our biggest challenges to get around. And to I see Rabbi Shmuley on the line. So inspired by a rabbi on the line, to put my rabbi hat on, if you will. You know, there's a great story between Hillel and Shammai, right? These two great arguers of within the Talmud, and they have an argument before God. And God says, "Okay, Shammai, what's your argument?" And Shammai puts out an argument and says, "First of all, I don't even know why you're listening to Hillel. Hillel's an idiot. He doesn't know what he's talking about. His ideas are all wrong. We shouldn't even have this conversation. I'm right. Here's what I think." God says, "Okay, whew, all right, Hillel, what do you have to say?" And Hillel perfectly recites Shammai's argument with no editorializing, and then states his argument. Says it's in your hands, God. And God says Hillel is right. So the rabbis, of course, the question becomes like, well, so why is Hillel right? And the answer is because Hillel held space for the other person's argument and point of view. And we somehow have moved to this place where that we don't we're no longer interested in holding space for someone else's argument. We expect them to, or part they expect us to hold space for theirs while not holding ours. So part of it, I think, is a way finding the spaces where you can be curious and say that you want to hold space, but the other part is to stay in the rooms. There is something to be said about walking away, and if someone's not interested in dialogue, to not platform them and to, you know, not engage. But I think more often than not, we should try to find a place to engage. And I also think one of the ways that we combat it is, you know, when we see anti-Semitism, there's a sense of let's circle the wagons, let's become defensive, and I'm going to be anti-Semitism, and I'm going to be anti-Zionism, and we focus on the negative aspects. One for ourselves, the internal, is I think we need to remind ourselves of what we're for. What are the things that we're proud of? You know, I can talk about my own family. You know, I love the fact that with my two kids and my wife, we have made a tradition almost every Friday night. Sometimes when we don't, it's my fault because I'm traveling, but we go to the classmates and very, very dear close friends of ours, and we go to their house 3 minutes away, and our kids are together, and they light Shabbat candles, and we have a very beautiful Shabbat dinner. And that's right, that's something to be proud of. Or many people were a Magen David, but what does it mean? Why a Magen David? Why Star of David? Like, what makes us uniquely Jewish, and what are the things that we want to hold on to and be proud of? So one, I think that's something we should all engage in that exercise to help inoculate ourselves to the daily noise that we're hearing all around us. One. Two, in terms of the rage that we're seeing, I would just simply say this. I would say there seems to be a singular view of Jews, right? So that you're a Jew and your people went through the Holocaust. Therefore, you should know what it means not to be oppressive in any way. But you are being oppressive vis-a-vis Israel against Palestinians. Whether you agree with that, I'm not commenting whether I agree with that statement or not, but that certainly is an opinion. And then when Israel suddenly doesn't, or we as Jews don't act in the manner in which we supposedly are seen, or the view of how we're quote unquote supposed to be, people get angry at us. And I think that that's classic anti-Semitism. I think And I would ask people, and I oftentimes think that we can separate, we have to try and separate people. Like, well, I'm sorry, is your issue that the state of Israel exists, or is it with the current government? And how do you think I, though I'm outspoken, and a supporter of the state of Israel, how does that translate to hating me or shushing me? Because I am not in the Israeli government. I don't control any policy, whether I agree or not, but it is a Israel is nearly a $500 trillion economy. It has its own government, its people, its own worldview and culture. And, it's, I think, just try and get people to stop and listen and engage. I don't know. I think we have to be a little bit more thick-skinned in some circles. And it's tough. I don't know. I too have been very, it's interesting. I've been disappointed by some. But the truth is, I've been very surprised. I've had friends that took a while to respond, but then I had friends, Arabs in the Gulf from the Emirates, reach out and say, "How are you? And how are you feeling? And how are you dealing with the anti-Semitism around you?" And I think that that's the last part. I think we have to recognize who our friends are and recognize that when people don't stand up for us the way perhaps we stood up for them, it's potentially okay. In other words, it's not a transaction, right? You gave me $5, I'll give you $5. Maybe the manner in which people stand up for us is different than the way we stood up for them. And for those who have become like just nasty, which we see a lot of too, I think we have to either try to engage, and then if not, walk away. But do our darndest to try to walk away and try to leave, try to, even if we walk away, leave the door open for the possibility to engage at some point. Because I think that's the last piece. People underestimate the emotional tear that Jews have. We talk a lot, especially in progressive circles, about trauma, right? Like, and I think, but we forget the fact that, one of the things I find myself saying is that had a bomb gone off in southern Israel, God forbid, and they murdered 1,200 people, it would have been far less traumatic than what happened. Hamas did what it did with intentionality to evoke generational trauma and trauma that is still in living memory of the Shoah, of how Jews were butchered and murdered. And Jews are still in captivity. And so anyone who wants to talk about a ceasefire, anyone who wants to talk about how Israel is wrong, anyone who wants to talk about fill in the blank, Jews did something wrong, assuming it's well intended, which I think in many cases it's not, I think we have to stop and try to humanize it first and say and remind them of the trauma. And if someone says, "Well, what about the Palestinians?" I would say, "Well, this isn't a victim derby about who's the bigger victim, one. Two, no, there's only victims with hate. So let's just stop. You're talking to me as a Jew. I can tell you as a Jew how I am feeling. And we can talk about Israel and we can talk about all these things. If you want to talk about the Palestinian, I can give you the Jewish perspective. I can give you my perspective as a Jew living in America. But let's before we leapfrog to that, let me share with you how I'm feeling in my day to day and how I wake up checking, like so many I know, waking up to check a WhatsApp and see, are my friends alive or dead? Or are their children alive or dead? Or are their neighbors alive or dead? Or are there reports about hostages? Which is weird, I've become numb to, but I think in a way, but I think we have to remind people that there's still an ongoing trauma. And if you want to have actually create progress and dialogue, we have to first acknowledge where we are as a people. Many Jews feel still very traumatized. And it's traumatizing to when you feel that you've been abandoned by your friends. And if they still don't accept you, then you're still my hermano. So we'll find new friends. Sorry, that was a long answer, but
No, thank you. That was a very complex question that I throw out there. And following the long lines of complexity within these dialogues, a lot of people tend to throw out some of the most anti-Semitic things and then hide under the notion that, no, I'm not being anti-Semitic, I'm only being anti-Zionist. How do we clearly define those distinctions?
Well, first of all, if I so I would do it two ways. First of all, I would say let's drop the anti-Semitism as a phrase anyway, when it's invented, is meant to sound smart and scientific. So one is like let's call it what it is. I mean, anti-Semitism is a category, is a kind of a catch-all, and it feels a little clumsy. That's why I just prefer like just call it what it is. And Ronald Lauder says the same, which is like let's just call it what it is. You hate Jews. For one reason or another, right? And anti-Zionism, in a way, is because, well, anti-Semitism feels a little bit inappropriate, so let me try to use a newer phrase. So I think we have to kind of decode that as well. And so when you say, if someone says, well, I'm an anti-Zionist, which I've had, I say, well, what does that mean? Does that mean you, as in you don't believe that the state of Israel has a right to exist? And if someone says, well, no, I'll say, so Jews, and usually someone will say, no, Palestinians should have their state. And I'll say, okay, so you believe in Palestinian self-determination? Yes. Okay. Do Jews have a right for self-determination in their indigenous land? Usually people will say yes. Say, like, hey, congratulations, you're a Zionist. Does it mean you agree with how the state of Israel exists? You mean, I mean, you know. There's two things at play. Sometimes people want to go down the rabbit hole and argue with you about history, about who got there first. And so we could say, like, well, Arabs have been there for hundreds of years. And you're like, well, Arabs come from Arabia, and the first Arab conquest, so the first colonial enterprise, was in the 7th century. Jews had already been living in the land for nearly a millennia before that. So what are we talking about? And people say, well, but they were more, and so we go down the rabbit hole of history, which I think in one hand I would say is important, but on the other hand, it doesn't get us anywhere today. There are Arabs living there today, there are Jews living there today, and a mix of others, and how do we find a solution, right? Just as people will say that Palestinian people don't exist. Okay, at a certain point in antiquity, that's true. I hope that doesn't offend anyone, but that's a reality. But does that mean that they don't exist today? No, of course not. They do exist today. And it doesn't almost matter to have a discussion about antiquity. What matters is there are a group of people that have a shared identity today. And so as people in progressive circles, how do we move the ball forward in dialogue? I think, or now I already forgot the back end of your question. Forgive me. What was it again? The back end, sorry,
Like, where do we clearly define the lines of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism?
Oh, right. Got it. Perfect. Thanks. So people want to argue in an anti-Zionism. And so I think we have, and they want to go down the rabbit hole of history, which I don't think is helpful today. Just as when people say whether they're anti-Zionism or anti-Semitism, number one, if it comes to anti-Semitism, I'm Jewish. So I feel that I am somewhat better informed to know what feels offensive than someone else. So I think we should own that. And if someone says no, it's like, okay, well, I could say an expletive, right? The classic would be an N-word. So if I don't think that's offensive, does that matter? No, it doesn't matter if I think it's offensive or not. And who says it's offensive? It's the black community. So I, as a non-black person, should accept that. Somehow we have lost this notion that Jews are not allowed to define ourselves, which goes back to where we started at the top, which is the majority is defining us. We somehow have lost that narrative that we as a minority, we are being told who we are, what we are, how we should be. And no, that doesn't work that way. If someone asks, I will tell you what anti-Semitism is. And in terms of how do you find that line, distinction between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, I would just simply say, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And can you be anti-Zionist? Sure. The Satmar Haredi, a small sect, a religious sect of Hasidim, don't believe in the state of Israel. Even though they live there, they don't believe in the secular state, I should say. So would they call themselves anti-Zionist? Yes, but it's that works for them, and it works in the language that they travel in. I have yet to see any pro-Palestinian protest or ceasefire protest that doesn't traffic in anti-Semitic language. I just haven't seen it. Maybe they exist. I just haven't seen it. Oh, and that's the last thing I'll say also in terms of the anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. There's a false narrative we also have to push back against. This false binary of if you are pro-Israel and Jewish, you automatically are anti-Palestinian. And if you're pro-Palestinian, it means automatically you are anti-Zionist and anti-Israel, and you don't believe the state should exist or anti-Jew. And I don't think that that's, I think it's a very, it's, I think it's a false binary. You ask any Israeli who lives in the region with Arab neighbors, and they'll say, like, what are you talking about? I think that we have to be careful of that, and we have to remind people of that. And look, the other part, the last thing I said, I already said last thing. The last thing is, I think there's a weird dynamic in the West where we armchair politic about what happens in the rest of the world, and we think we know best. And for some reason, we don't want to listen to minorities. We've seen the same thing for those that are, there. And by the way, I think as Latinos, we could point to the same. Some people think that we're that all, anyone who's Latino, we're all the same. We're not all the same. Even within Mexico, we have diversity of opinion, let alone every other Latin American country, right? And we see that in American politics, right? So Cubans in Florida have a very different political outlook, generally speaking, than the Latino communities of the Southwest on everything from immigration. The only thing maybe is sometimes like on the conservative, like Catholic values. But when it comes to issues like immigration and how is the border understood, et cetera, wildly different. And I would argue largely because for people that are Mexican, it's a lived experience, right? You look at Nogales and the fence like cuts the city in half. It's a lived experience. But that's different from Cubans fleeing Cuba who are in Florida now, right? It's just different. So yeah, I think we have to, again, I don't know. I think we have to come back in dialogue, and sorry, it's a rambling answer. All right, I'll stop.
You're good. We have a question from somebody on Facebook, and
Sure.
I wanted to just make sure we address this question. In the time of
Yeah.
incredible misinformation, how do we bring in proper information that doesn't feel like it's dismissing people's real pain when sharing these clearly propagandic statements?
Oh, well, first things first. I think anytime we read a story or we see a picture, we have to step backwards and think about what was the story that the person, who's behind the lens, and what's the story that they're trying to tell, and is it being manipulated, right? I think so. This in this way, for example, I think Holocaust education can help inform us, right? So the Nazis used to take pictures of Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto in part because they wanted to show Jews, say, look, they're like vermin. And they were staged photos. And so at first glance, it looked, I mean, the pictures are awful. But it's like, well, who's taking these pictures? So then once you realize who's taking the picture, the next logical question is why? What is the story that they're trying to tell? And I think, frankly, we have to engage some critical thinking skills, number one. And number two, in terms of like the real pain of people, look, I think we have to spend more time talking to each other. Like face to face, although this is Zoom, and less time on our phones. Because, and this is something that Eddie and I come together, and I know Rabbi Shmuley and Arizona Jews for Justice and Tzedek America, is we seem to groups, so many people spend time talking about people versus talking to people. And we have to spend more time talking to each other. We have to spend time talking to lived experiences. And I think that there's also this other idea that we see sometimes, like from the anti-racist movement, of like, well, love will conquer all. I don't think that's sustainable. I think we have to spend time talking to each other. So I think we have to consider our sources for where we're getting our news. Don't immediately believe things that we see online. So if you're going to share it, try to vet it before you share it, because then it's once you share something, it's out into the ether and it has an exponential kind of effect. And two, Don't mitigate people's pain. It's not, again, it's not an either or, right? So just because I wear a dog tag for a hostage doesn't mean that it doesn't disturb me that civilians are killed in a war zone or that there are innocent Palestinians. Of course not. I'm human. I'm a father. I have children. And I have ch want my children to have a better life than me, just like I would argue all people, or certainly most. I think we have to also give people a little credit. We can hold two things can be true at the same time. It's not a one or the other. And I think that's how we have to push back against that.
Thank you so much, Randy. We're going to open it up now for questions. If you
Sure.
are on Facebook, if you are on our live here, you can feel free to send us any questions. We'll be happy to answer. And just as I said that, we got a question. The question is,
Great.
should we stay in progressive spaces despite anti-Semitism, or should we stick to our own communities right now?
Yeah, that one I think I can actually be succinct and short. We need to keep building bridges. I think, unfortunately, just in Rabbi Yitz that you guys had on, which is so great too, kind of echoing the same sentiment, we have to stay engaged. We have to stay engaged. We have to find the corners of where we can have a conversation with someone. And if 10 people shout, but there's one person that's like, I think you're crazy, but I'll sit down with you for 5 minutes, you stay in the room and you take the 5 minutes. We only will make progress and make allies if we're willing to sit in the room and potentially hear things that are uncomfortable because, and that's okay. We have to sometimes hold space for someone else's point of view, even if we think it's totally backwards and wrong. If we have to hold space for it if we want them to hold space for ours. So I think we can't. Now, if those progressive circles become so toxic that they won't hold space for any of your perspective, then potentially I think yes, maybe you find other progressive circles if where you're not silenced, but maybe give it the good old like collegiate heave ho and at least try to engage first before walking away.
Thank you. Well, another question that came in is, do you think anti-Semitism will be added to DEI spaces?
It should be. It absolutely should be. The problem, I think DEI in theory, when it started, and which we've seen an evolution, in the beginning, to me, it made sense. Now the challenge is that in so many spaces, DEI has looked for the binary, which look, that's how the human mind works. We want to make it easy. Our minds want to make things easy. Black and white, right or wrong, even though we live in a world full of color. I think that it should be, but it won't be because DEI has gone to this binary of if, for example, if there's a lot of Jews in entertainment, then in the movie industry, more than their population, right? Percent of population, they can only have achieved that by being an oppressor. And if there is a shortage of Nigerian women in entertainment, less than their percentage of the population, it is only because they're being oppressed. And it totally takes away the nuance and context, right? Jews are in Hollywood because, in large ways, Jews were banned from theater, which was a form of major form of entertainment a century ago. And the Warner Bros. And even when it came to the movie industry, where Jews were kind of allowed in. Look, the Warner Brothers had the first what was called the talkie, right? Al Jolson, the jazz singer, and Hollywood was born because it was like, oh my God, instead of reading a cue card, we could actually hear the audio of the actors in the movie. Unbelievable. So it's one of the reasons why you see Jews overrepresented in entertainment. It's a legacy from that time. Just as if you go into a hospital, there's a lot of Filipino nurses. Why? That's not because they're oppressors. It's because in the Philippines, they recognize one of the pathways for those in the Philippines to gain greater economic successes Here's a program. We'll train you as a nurse, and we'll ship you out to the. You'll be able to go to the States and get a job, support your family. It doesn't mean that they're oppressors. So I think it should be, but I don't think it will be because a lot of DEI programs have moved to this false binary where they're kind of skipping. And if Jews are white, then why would they belong in DEI? Because they're a part of the upper class. They're a part of the establishment.
Perfect. Randy, thank you so much. Your knowledge is just incredible. I look up to you in so many ways. And we here at Early Tzedek really appreciate our partnership with you and Tzedek America. We're so blessed to have such an incredible partner and educator. This is such a tough topic, especially with folks who share so many different identities and feel so crushed by the just immense amounts of anti-Semitism that we wake up to every day, and feeling the incredible pain of the hostages still not being released. We're going past 6 months now with still no release. And this is an incredible time for us to, just like you said, come together and inspire to do good and fight for justice and continue to support vulnerable populations, whether that's with our education, direct volunteering. We can do that together. And we're actually having a panel in our next hour to talk about ethical consumption. Randy, thank you so much. We appreciate you and appreciate all of you who are listening to this, whether it be on recording, live. We thank you. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you.